So I'm going to first ask Herman Daly, who is a professor at the University of Maryland in School of Public Affairs. From 1988 to 94, he was a senior economist in the Environment Department of the World Bank. He has served as a Ford Foundation visiting professor at the University of Ceará in Brazil, as a research associate at Yale University, and as a senior Fulbright lecturer in Brazil. He has served on board of numerous environmental organizations, and his interest in economic development, population resources, and the environment has resulted in several hundred articles in professional journals, as well as numerous books. He's also somebody who's inspired activists like me because we knew what was going on inside the bank. He's one of those people who has given us hope that there is hope even within the bank. We can work with those colleagues to actually dismantle that institution. So let's give a big hand to Herman Daly, who's dared to be different.
Thank you very much, and it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm very grateful to be a part of this occasion, and especially to be here in Foundry Methodist Church, where it just so happens that I was a member for 5 years of this congregation, and I have for many, many Sundays sat out in the pews where you are, but this is the first time that I've been looking the other way, and I confess that I kind of secretly hoped that I might be speaking from the pulpit over there, but I think, I think this is better. So, and I want to say that even though this is this teach-in, this event, is basically secular in nature, I'm personally very glad that it's being held in a sanctuary, which is dedicated to the good news of justice, love, liberation, and forgiveness. And so I'm very grateful to the congregation of Foundry Church and to Philip Waugaman for making this available. Well, that's the end of my sermonette. Moved from the sermon now to the lecture. So if you read the newspapers and watch the TV, you get the impression that anyone who opposes globalization must be an isolationist, or even worse, a xenophobe, or even worse, someone who does not share the dream of a world without poverty, along with the World Bank. Nonsense, utter nonsense. I don't know anyone in this movement who is an isolationist or a xenophobe. The relevant conflict is not that. The relevant conflict, I believe, is between globalization and internationalization. The newspapers don't know the difference, and so let's talk about the difference. What is the definition of these terms, and why is the distinction so important? By internationalization, I mean the increasing importance of relationships between and among nations, international trade, international treaties, alliances, protocols, Montreal Protocol, Kyoto Protocol, cultural interchange. All of these relationships among nations become more and more important. However, the basic unit remains the nation, the basic unit of community within which people cooperate and take responsibility for each other remains the nation, even as relations among nations become increasingly necessary and important. That's internationalization. That was the model on which the Bretton Woods institutions were created in 1944. Globalization is something entirely and radically different. Globalization refers to the global economic integration of many formerly national economies into one global economy. And that takes place by free trade, especially by free capital mobility, and to a far lesser extent by easy or uncontrolled migration, generally in the interest of cheap labor. So globalization is the effective erasure of national boundaries for economic purposes. National boundaries become porous with respect to the flow of goods, capital, and to an increasing degree, people viewed as cheap labor. So the alternative to globalization, then, is not isolationism or xenophobia. It's rather internationalization, what the Bretton Woods institutions were designed for before their recent subversion by the globalizers. Well, continuing with somewhat pedantic approach to definitions and all, the word integration, as in global economic integration, which is globalization, the word integration derives from the word integer. Integer means one, complete, or whole. So integration is the act of combining into one whole. And since there can be only one whole, only one unity with reference to which parts are integrated, it follows then that global economic integration logically implies national economic disintegration. The parts of the economy have to be torn out of their national organized context and in order to be reintegrated into the new global context. As the saying goes, to make an omelet, you have to break some eggs. The disintegration of the national egg is necessary to integrate the global omelet. And so while the word integration may have nice vibrations when you talk about it, when you start thinking about the disintegration of national economies and the costs that are consequent upon that, it loses some of its shine. Well, all that I have just said, I believe, was expressed with admirable clarity and brevity by Renato Ruggiero, who was the former Director General of the WTO. And he said the following, quote, "We are no longer writing the rules of interaction among separate national economies. We are writing the constitution of a single global economy." I think this is a clear affirmation of globalization, as I've just defined it, and a clear rejection of internationalization, as just defined. It is also a radical subversion of the basic charter of the Bretton Woods institutions, which was based on internationalization, federation of nations. So, if the IMF, the WTO, and the World Bank have switched, sort of changed their charter, or just thrown away the old charter and said, now we're interested in globalization, if they're no longer serving the interests of their member nations as per their charter, then whose interests are they serving? Well, we're told the interest of the global economy. But that's a great big abstraction. If you look behind that abstraction for the concrete reality, what do you find? I think you find giant corporations, the big fictitious individuals, not real individual workers, peasants, or even middle-class folks. So that's, I think, very important to keep in mind, the distinction between globalization and internationalization. And I'd like to then just briefly consider a few further consequences of moving towards globalization. Globalization undercuts the ability of nations to count all costs, to internalize all environmental and social costs into prices, so that prices really tell the truth about the total sacrifices that are being made in production. Economic integration under free market conditions promotes a standards-lowering competition, or a kind of race to the bottom. The country that does the poorest job of counting all costs ends up with the cheapest product and with the benefit, the competitive advantage in international trade. So more and more then of world production tends to shift towards those countries that do the poorest job of counting all environmental and social costs, and this leads to a kind of race to the bottom, a sure recipe for reducing efficiency of production rather than increasing it. And as these uncounted externalized costs increase, then the relationship of measured GNP to real welfare becomes worse and worse and a more and more misleading index. Another point that to make on globalization is that fostering global competitive advantage is used as an excuse, frequently in this country and others, an excuse for tolerance of corporate mergers and tolerance of monopoly. The idea is we can't have a competitive market structure in the United States or in some other country because we have to compete in the global market. So we need really big corporations to go out and compete in the global market. And if that means they're going to be monopolies at home, well, you know, too bad, that's what we have to do. Chicago School economist and Nobel laureate Ronald Coase said many years ago in his writing on the theory of the firm that firms and corporations are islands of central planning in a sea of market relationships. The islands of central planning become larger and larger relative to the remaining sea of market relationships. More and more resources are allocated by the within-firm principle of central planning, and less are resources allocated by the between-firm principle of market competitive relationships. And this is hailed as a victory for markets. It's no such thing. It's a victory for corporations relative to national governments, which are no longer strong enough to regulate corporate capital in the public interest. Of the 100 largest economic organizations, 52 are corporations, 48 are nations, a statistic we often hear, but it's extremely important. And the distribution of income within these islands of central planning, within the corporations, is itself becoming much more concentrated. The ratio of salary of chief executive officer to average worker in the corporation has now passed 400 on its way to infinity, and that's probably what we should expect if the chief central planner sets their own salaries. So I don't know about you, but I'm tired of seeing our free market subverted by a bunch of pinko corporate central planners intent on global domination. Another point is that free trade and free capital mobility increase the pressure for specialization according to comparative or competitive advantage among nations. Therefore, the range of choice by which people are able to earn their living, to earn their income, is reduced as you globalize and specialize in this way. And that's a real welfare cost. As an example, if you take the little country of Uruguay, they have a clear comparative advantage in raising sheep and cattle. So according to the comparative advantage doctrine and global integration and fitting the international economy, every Uruguayan has a choice of occupation. He can either be a shepherd or a cowboy. Now, if you want to be an airline pilot or play in a symphony orchestra, too bad, you have to immigrate to some other country. Because this is a comparative advantage. So this is a tremendous restriction. I mean, that hasn't happened because Uruguay has resisted it, but that's the logic of the system. And trade economists just don't count the welfare loss of restricting the range of choice of occupation among people. Yet I know from students that most of us gain most of our satisfaction in life, more of our satisfaction in life, from the way we earn our income than from the way that we spend it. And so that range of choice is reduced. At the same time, the range of choice of how we spend our income receives enormous overemphasis. They're eager to give us all sorts of choices about how you spend your income. For example, the United States imports Danish butter cookies, and the Danes import U.S. butter cookies. And somewhere over the North Atlantic, the butter cookies pass each other at the expense of a whole lot of fossil fuel. Well, is that really efficient? Is that really a good way to organize the world? Economists say, well, you're being an elitist now. Back off, because cookie connoisseurs really do benefit from the difference between Danish and American butter cookies. And so you're, okay, maybe so, maybe so. But even if that's the case, wouldn't it be cheaper to just trade recipes? Uh, But trading recipes, ooh, recipes, recipes, that's trade-related intellectual property rights. And that's the one thing that the free traders really want to protect. They don't want to see free trade and information and property rights. But knowledge is, of all things, is the thing that should be most shared, because in sharing knowledge, knowledge is multiplied rather than divided. Thomas Jefferson's statement, knowledge is the common property of mankind. The trade theorists have sort of forgotten that, and they're in the service of creating further corporate monopoly rights on knowledge, which are now supposed to be enforced worldwide through the WTO and all of that. Well, I'll leave that subject to others in the teach-in who know more about it. And I close with my favorite quote from John Maynard Keynes, one of the intellectual founders of the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank. And Keynes, in a speech to people in Ireland, said the following. He said, "I sympathize, therefore, with those who would minimize rather than those who would maximize economic entanglement between nations. Ideas, knowledge, art, hospitality, travel, these are the things which should, of their nature, be international. But let goods be homespun whenever it is reasonably and conveniently possible. And above all, let finance be primarily national." Big difference. Well, it's not my intention here to demonize the IMF, the World Bank, and the WTO. They need total reform. I think the criticisms of they have become autistic and isolated within their habitual assumptions. When the World Bank speaks to us through its annual World Development Report, I think all that one really hears is the unison snoring of supine economists in deep dogmatic slumber. And the aims of the street demonstration, I believe, is not to harm these sleepwalkers, but to wake them up before they cause still more destruction. Thank you.